Walking while black in Jacksonville. Why an investigation shows some residents are losing their driver's license over pedestrian tickets. Senator Marco Rubio might be a no on that big tax reform bill. And Mayor Curry is offering up the shipyards to Amazon. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we're always live on the radio at 9. You can also listen to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and through our app. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, holiday cheer all around town. We'll have a look ahead to the Apex Theater series of holiday shows, plus a big concert coming up at Unity Plaza to brighten the holidays of less fortunate children in Jacksonville. We'll tell you about that. And a live in-studio performance from the city's own Madison Carr. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday and a busy news week to discuss, and we're always excited to welcome our Friday Media Roundtable. Here today, Andrew Pantazzi, reporter for the Florida Times Union.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. Claire Goforth is here. She's editor at Folio Weekly.
Season's greetings.
Season's greetings to you. And A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics.
Happy Hanukkah.
hey, we're going to say Merry Christmas again.
Okay. If I'm here next week, Merry Christmas. But it's Hanukkah right now.
Lots to discuss this week. Everything from Marco Rubio threatening to derail the Republican tax reform bill to Mayor Lenny Curry releasing his big proposal for Amazon as Jacksonville tries to lure that retail giant's second headquarters to town. But our top story this morning, the Florida Times Union released an update this week on its big investigation with ProPublica. It's their Walking While Black series. And what they found is that more than half of the 2,000 people who received pedestrian tickets in Jacksonville also got their driver's license suspended over it. Now, losing your driver's license in a big city like ours can be a challenge, but what has many people asking questions is how someone could lose their license for something that has nothing to do with operating a vehicle. State Senator Jeff Brandis of Pinellas County has introduced a bill several times in Tallahassee that would prevent someone from losing their driver's license for a pedestrian offense, but it's never been passed into law. This series has struck a chord with lawmakers and community activists because some have lost their licenses over pedestrian tickets that the investigation found were improperly given out. So we begin the roundtable with a closer look at this follow-up. Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. You can also let us know what you think about this on our Facebook page. Andrew Pantazzi, let's begin with you. Your colleagues at the Times Union, in conjunction with the national organization ProPublica, published this investigation and the follow-up, and now lawmakers are asking questions, along with community activists, in the wake of your organization's reporting.
Yeah, so to summarize, to get anyone up to speed who has not read the great reporting that my colleague Ben Konark and then Topher Sanders have done, basically they took a look at all the pedestrian tickets that have been given out, and then they looked at where all the pedestrian fatalities were happening and found that tickets were not being enforced in the places that were actually most dangerous, but were actually being enforced in zip codes that were the poorest and had the heaviest concentration of black residents. And in fact, the tickets were disproportionately going to black pedestrians, even though black pedestrians did not make up a large number of the fatalities. So if you were to use that as a sort of control for are they committing more jaywalking, at least the fatality numbers don't show that. And then secondly, that some of these tickets are being given apparently erroneously. One of the most common reasons for giving a ticket is that you are crossing the street between two traffic lights. And in fact, they're giving it in places where there are not traffic lights. That is, there are stop signs or things like that where you should be allowed to cross the street. And so the police officers perhaps are unknowingly giving these tickets when they can't. And so they looked at all of that and they went to the sheriff's office and then they dug deeper to see what happened after people got the pedestrian tickets, which is people lose their driver's licenses. And in some cases, they found even teenagers, before they have a chance at getting a driver's license, have that right revoked from them, and they can't get the driver's license until they pay off this pedestrian ticket. So what Jeff Brandy's out of Pinellas County has proposed multiple times is, he says, it doesn't make sense for someone who has committed a non-moving, non-traffic violation, that they were not driving, to now lose their ability to work, lose their ability to find a job and to be able to actually pay off these tickets. It's somewhat similar to the idea that if you don't pay your student loans, you can get your nursing license revoked or other professional licenses. You're taking away a person's ability to earn income because they aren't paying something, likely because they're already poor.
It's 549-2937. Let us know what you think. Should people lose their license over a pedestrian ticket? Some lawmakers are trying to change that law in Florida over a pedestrian ticket. Claire Goforth, community groups like the NAACP, the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville, and some members of the Jacksonville City Council have prevailed upon JSO to just stop issuing these tickets altogether for the time being. For his part, though, JSO Sheriff Mike Williams has said, look, there's no intentional effort to discriminate when we issue these tickets.
Right. I mean, it may be an issue of implicit bias. On the flip side of that is that, I mean, we've all seen pedestrians who are behaving extremely unsafely. There's a stretch on Beach Boulevard where you frequently see people just streaking, or not streaking,
and that's the rationale for issuing the tickets.
Yeah. But then again, it doesn't increase safety. So, you know, we're left with this question of whether or not we even should have these laws on the books at all. I did find it interesting, and that was great reporting by the Times Union and ProPublica. I mean, really excellent work. I looked at the number that you reported, that there were 19 motor officers in the sheriff's office force. So based on the base salary of JSO officers and the average salary after 6 years, we're paying as taxpayers between $700,000 and $1 million a year just in the salaries for those 19 officers. So we have to ask ourselves as a community, is it worth that investment? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. AG Gankarski, there are a lot of stories to catch our attention, and we'll move on in a moment to a few more. But this is one that's, I think, puts Jacksonville in familiar camps, particularly when you look at the fact that people see this through the prism of their economic background, their race. It's certainly not good news on the national front for Jacksonville to have this investigation get such wide play around the country.
Well, more things change, more they stay the same. Jacksonville is still coming out of its Jim Crow past, and these stops are a pretext for stop and frisk. Some people at council made that point Tuesday night, and that's pretty obvious. And the council members who have spoken up on this issue, the question is begged, why haven't they spoken up on the larger issue, which is, you know, things like marijuana enforcement and other things that actually, you know, are what, you know, JSO is directly looking for. They're looking for weed, they're looking for guns, they're looking for et cetera. Pat Ivey has said as much, as you know, the undersheriff, that it's their pretextual searches. And, you know, this is really a question about civil liberties that goes far beyond jaywalking and our people being jobbed out of being able to get their driver's licenses because of fines. I mean, this is an issue of what law enforcement and the rule of law is. And the rule of law, if you are poor and black in the city, is much different. The rule of law is one of coercion. The rule of law is one that, you know, by and large holds you down. And, you know, it's up to the people on council, especially from District 7 through 10, to actually make those points. And if they need a Times Union article, you know, to actually, you know, spur them to action, it raises the question, what are they doing on the council?
There's an interesting, I mean, seeing how the police union is responding, for example, Anna Brochet, the city council president, has raised questions about this. And the police union president, Steve Zone, on Twitter and on Facebook,
he said, clean up your own house first before taking shots at us.
Yeah. So he is essentially telling the body that gives the funding to the sheriff's office that they should not question what police officers do. Which is remarkable.
Yeah, this goes back to the budget in August also, when the Finance Committee was asking, well, why do you need these new cops? And basically, they're pushing back against 100 new cops that the mayor and the sheriff were requesting. But in that whole discussion, believe me, I was there for the whole thing. Not one time was civil liberties mentioned. Not one time was disproportionate enforcement mentioned. And, you know, maybe it's because Katrina Brown and Garrett Dennis and Reggie Brown and Reggie Gaffney just can't carry the ball on that. Maybe that's just not a priority to them. But, you know, this is really something where we need a real community discussion, not just on the provenance of jaywalking citations, but how law enforcement actually works. And we're not really getting that yet.
All right. And to Claire's point, I mean, it is about priorities because it's about prioritizing what is most important out of a sheriff's office, even. Is it solving the crimes that occur? Is it proactive policing where you're going into a community and you're looking for people who are violating the law? Where do you want to see the staff grow and where do you want to see the staff taken away from in order to grow in other areas? Same with, you know, speeding or traffic enforcement. There's, you know, a budget is always a list of priorities.
Sure. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. What are your thoughts about the biggest stories of the week? 549-2937. Mark is on the west side right now. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I don't think this is good reporting at all. I mean, first off, I think it's silly to have the police department try to meet their quota of tickets by giving tickets to anybody, anywhere. But doesn't it make sense that the lower socioeconomic group of any city is going to be walking more and therefore would get more jaywalking tickets? And also, this is, I think, trying to stoke the flames. How is this a racist thing when you do not know the race of the police officers giving tickets? This could be every ticket given could be given by a black police officer. So how would that be racist? But we don't know. So the implied bias here is that the bad old white Ku Klux Klan police officers of the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office are racist and giving more tickets to poor black people than they are to anybody else. And that's just facetious on the face of it.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. And let me just jump in and say that's not the first time a caller has asked us to clarify, well, how many black officers are giving out tickets? Or in the case of bias in the classroom, how many black teachers are giving referrals to unruly kids?
We're talking about institutional racism.
Exactly, right. What I would say to Mark and anyone who's made that point is that these are systemic biases that have been internalized by both white officers and African-American officers, by both white teachers and teachers of color. It's not about white officers picking on black citizens. This is a systemic problem of implicit bias that all of us, all Americans, hold. And so I just think that's a red herring, frankly, to throw that out. And the data proves that out, not the data in this Walking While Black series, but many other studies that have been done about this. Also, Andrew Pantazzi, to get to Mark, the caller's other question, well, why maybe it's poorer people that are jaywalking more? That question has come up, too. Yeah. And what does the data show to answer his question there?
Yeah, so to address Mark's point in several ways. First, about the fact that poor people are more likely to walk. If we take the purpose of enforcing these pedestrian laws, which I believe there are 23 different pedestrian laws that you can be cited for, or thereabouts. If you take it as it's about primarily pedestrian safety, that Jacksonville is one of the least safe cities in America for pedestrians, unfortunately, and the sheriff's office in good faith is trying to help reduce that, then what the reporters were doing is saying, let's look at where those fatalities are occurring, where are the pedestrians most in danger, and look at where the enforcement is being placed. And then in addition to that, the idea, and AG briefly touched on this with the term institutionalized racism, is not that this is an explicit form of racism. It's not that they are trying to hurt. In some cases, it's in fact the opposite. It's trying to help reduce things like pedestrian fatalities. And it's not even the officers themselves, but rather where they are being assigned. An officer is not going to say, I choose to be in 32209 enforcing pedestrian laws. They're more likely going to be assigned that task. And so it's looking at the sheriff's office. Are they actually using their resources in the best manner possible, even according to their own stated purpose. If their purpose is they want to reduce fatalities, then they are in fact putting their officers in places where there are lower fatalities, and they're more aggressively using these tickets. In addition, I would ask Mark to look at the story and see how the largest reason people these officers use for giving tickets is erroneous. They're saying it's because you're between two traffic lights, and in fact, I think it was just over 50% of those traffic tickets, they mapped them, are not between two traffic lights. So perhaps that's just a need for more training at the sheriff's office or more looking into what the jaywalking laws actually state.
Or like AG said, it's often a pretext for a stop and frisk and to, you know, look at suspicions of some other criminal activity. In that case, people are losing far more than just the cost of the ticket or a license. They could be losing their freedom.
I mean, my friends who are African-American males in my demographic have told me for decades they could be walking in Riverside, Avondale, whatever, and if a cop believes they matched a description of a suspect, they will have a conversation. And, you know, those descriptions are so malleable. African-American male, 6 foot tall, approximately with dreadlocks or something. You know, it's absurd. And I think this investigation from the Times Union and ProPublica gets to, you know, part of it. But, you know, really, this is what rule of law actually means. Rule of law is a way of, you know, protecting, you know, vested interest against the underclass. And this is what it looks like. This is what stop and frisk looks like. This is what Giuliani did in New York. It's not that dissimilar. And, you know, laws are very often pretext. You can ask Corrine Brown about that.
Kevin on the west side. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yes, good morning. On this jaywalking thing, I haven't heard anybody saying anything about why people don't use the crosswalk. They walk across the road outside the crosswalk. And when that red hand is up on the pole across the street, they walk across anyway, and they don't seem to care.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it's a black thing, a white thing, if I see them both do.
Okay, sure, Kevin. And yeah, to be clear, you shouldn't jaywalk.
Yeah.
You should follow traffic laws.
And Kevin, this is actually something that was addressed in the story as well, is the city has asked a consultant to even look at why is Jacksonville such an unsafe city for pedestrians. And the reason is not pedestrian behavior, but actually infrastructure. So especially you think of Beach Boulevard, and you go there, and just how far you have to walk. In some places, you have to walk more than a mile to get to a crosswalk. And so just to cross the street, you're going to have to walk a mile just to go what would be a right angle, just straight ahead, crossing the street instead is going to take you a mile of walking. And that is, to be blunt, ridiculous. The lack of access for pedestrians, those who do not have cars to cross a street. And so in those cases, now that's not to say that there are not areas where people.
Oh, I see people jaywalking all the time. I mean,
yeah,
and I'll just come right out and admit I've jaywalked and nobody's ever given me a ticket, but I've done it.
And to that point, the reporters documented with video and photos that police officers are just as likely as anyone else. If you look downtown near the courthouse all the time, the police officers are crossing the street illegally and are breaking the law by not using the crosswalk in the intended manner in the same way. But in those cases, again, the question is anyone really at risk because there's no cars coming? So so in the same way that in these neighborhoods where they're being enforced, where there's not a high pedestrian fatality rate, is this, in fact, just being used as a pretext, as both AGS said and in fact, the undersheriff did, in fact, say he uses this as a way to find drugs and guns.
Janice in Riverside. Hi, Janice. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I work with biases all the time. And you guys have been using the terms implicit and explicit biases, and I haven't necessarily heard whether you've defined what those are or if you've talked about Harvard University online assessment tools that allow people, both, you know, of any color, to go on and test their own implicit bias for not only just race, but also skin tone amongst people of color, as well as sizeism, ageism, implicit biases against Arabs. Harvard University has been running this study for decades, and it's really a fascinating study to see, for you to see what your own implicit biases are, and then you can actively work against them.
Sure. Thank you so much, Janice, for that and pointing that out, because as I tried, the point I tried to make a minute ago is that this isn't to say that white police officers or white teachers are bad or evil or racist necessarily in any way. We all as a society hold implicit biases, and that includes people of color too. Women hold misogynistic biases against other women because this is how we've been socialized all of our lives. And so understanding that dynamic is the best way to dismantle it. This is something all of us are dealing with. This is the, you know, this is the cultural water we swim in. And you don't know you're wet when you've been in this water your whole life until you recognize this dynamic and try to overcome it in your decisions, in the way you evaluate people, in policy, everything.
Yeah, and I mean, JSO could absolutely make a strong stand to say that we're going to try to fight against this implicit bias if they would admit there's a problem and have a conversation about it.
And one of the proposed legislative solutions is to eliminate tickets on the first time, but rather using a warning system. That if you see someone crossing the street and you think that they're putting themselves or others in danger, that you just tell them, as an officer, this is officially a warning. You need to not do that. You are violating the law. And then that would seem to have a more safety approach. If you're actually trying to approach it from safety, then tell people not to cross the street on their first time.
While still allowing the cop to talk to the perceived suspect and see if there's anything else he might know or whatever and go from there. So, it's a Band-Aid solution to a larger cultural malaise.
Well, there are still many people waiting on hold to talk about it. It is a big talker, and kudos to the reporting on that. But we do need to move on and talk about some other headlines for the week. And the number to join us is 549-2937. Now, the other big thing capturing the nation's attention right now, one of many things happening in Washington that we've got our eyes on, is the tax bill compromise that was reached by House and Senate negotiators. It's expected to be unveiled Monday. This is the big tax bill Republicans are trying to enact. But at least one new Republican senator may make that difficult. It's Senator Marco Rubio of Florida. Rubio now says he's going to vote no on this bill unless it is changed to include a larger expansion of the child tax credit for working families. The amount of that is currently set at $2,000 per child, but only refundable up to $1,100. Rubio's been fighting for this inclusion in the bill for some time. So let us know right now, what do you think about the tax bill, and are you for it or against it? And what do you think about Senator Rubio's position? It's 549-2937 to let us know your thoughts about the tax plan that, by the way, Claire, is changing by the day. We're trying to follow all of the changes, and it may or may not make it into law. But if it does, our tax system will be radically different.
It will be. And they have been working on this for all of 6 weeks to completely rewrite the United States tax code. I think without any input from Democrats, as far as I can tell, I think we're seeing signs of a larger fracture within the Republican Party as Marco Rubio may be the first to say, no, I'm not going to fall in line on this one, as there seem to be starting to distance themselves more and more from the policies and desires of the Trump administration.
A.G. Gankarski, what about the conservative arguments for tax reform, that reducing taxes will create more jobs and unleash innovation? That's certainly been at the heart of the Republican desire to do this.
Yeah, I mean, that's one interpretation of what this tax bill will do. Fed Chair Janet Yellen forecasts 2.5% growth for the economy. The Trump plan is predicated on 3 or 4% growth. We are entering the end of a false boom that was predicated on inflation and monetary supply. That's why we see the wealth distribution the way it is. That's why we see purchasing power less than it's been for middle and lower class people. But, the upper class, the C-suite, that's fine. This is the end of the 2008 recovery, the post-2008 recovery. And, this tax bill, it will probably get through in some form. It's going to be a kick to a sensitive area of the middle class. That's all I can say about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting to see about Senator Rubio here, as well as Senator Mike Lee out of Utah.
And Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee.
Well I'm talking about those.
Leaving.
Well, Senator Corker's issues are different. His are about the deficit. But Senator Mike Lee and Senator Rubio, they both have they want to expand the child tax credit, which economists of all stripes, left and right, are in agreement on. It's one of the best anti-poverty measures this nation has, is both the EITC and then the child tax credit in terms of helping working poor families. And they want to expand it significantly, yet they've had no luck. And they've seen, as their Republican colleagues, people like Senator Rob Portman of Ohio, when he had an issue with pass-throughs. That's what a lot of small businesses and what a lot of businesses in Wisconsin are organized as. He said he would vote no, and the Republicans gave him what he wanted. Senator Rubio and Senator Lee said they wanted to expand the child tax credit, but neither of them were willing to vote no, and they didn't get what they wanted. And so I think Senator Rubio is seeing how the legislative game is playing on this bill, where every vote mm-hmm. counts. I think he's hoping that he'll get what he wants, because he seemed to be genuinely incensed that he was told repeatedly in public comments that the corporate tax rate was going to be cut to 20%, and they were not going to negotiate on that. And then they changed it to 21% so that they could appease other Republican senators. And he's like, if you were willing to raise it by 1% to help them, why won't you raise it to help me?
And by the way, let's point out, Rubio's not up for re-election next year.
No.
He will not face the voters for several more years. So this seems to be something that he's standing on principle. If it's a short-term, if he's making short-term political analyses about the politics of this bill, he does not face the voters next year.
And to put this in perspective, in 2012, when Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan put forward a corporate tax proposal that was then seen as pretty radical, it was to cut it to 25%. And a lot of people were wondering how that would be able to pay for itself. And now we're talking about 20%. At the same time, President Obama as well said that the corporate tax rate was too high and people were avoiding it because it was too high. And I believe he proposed 28%. And so this is a lot of people on both stripes view it as the corporate tax rate needs to be reformed. It does need to be cut. The question is, can you cut it to 20% and have it actually be revenue neutral, or is that just too far?
I think you have to look at Marco Rubio, too. Marco Rubio has talked a good game about being a check against President Trump, but in the end, he rolls over. There's a reason Trump called him Little Marco during the campaign. I don't think Rubio has done anything to shake that. I seriously doubt that Rubio votes against this bill in the end.
In the end he'll fold?
They'll give him a little something, and it'll be enough for him to justify his vote, the typical hand-wringing act from Rubio, and we'll move on.
Drew is along I-95 right now. Hi, Drew. Good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
All right, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Hey, the reason I'm calling is I know we're taking a look at a new tax plan, but our current tax plan that we have, if we went to the IRS site and downloaded it, would be about 10,000 pages. Now, we took a look at 6 weeks to update the tax code. I don't think there was a significant amount of review of the existing tax code that we have here. What's your thought?
Yeah, thank you for that, Drew.
This is a very interesting point that a lot of people are making about the way the legislative process is happening now. Basically, what we're seeing is the legislative process is occurring through think tanks and in closed-door meetings between the party in power. Whereas if you look at past efforts, and especially when it comes to tax reform, you think of the Ronald Reagan efforts in the 1980s, which had significant bipartisan support. Both parties supported it overwhelmingly. Democrats were in power of Congress at the time. And there were lots of meetings that happened over a long period of time where they were discussing the arcane minutiae of the tax reform plan at the time. And you compare that even to 2009 during the Affordable Care Act, where there were committee meetings that were held repeatedly out in the open. It was scored multiple times. And again, the arcane details were debated in minutiae, so much so that a lot of it was being changed repeatedly to accommodate all the different sides, the Democratic Party, which at that time had more conservative members. And you compare that to now. Now what's happening is legislation, not just this one, but a lot of legislation, is debated in these closed-door meetings where they're meeting with one another, or they're meeting with the Heritage Foundation, meeting with people, economists who have studied this issue and experts, but they're meeting in a closed-door setting so that they can feel on board. They can hear from an economist or a policy expert that says, don't worry, this will be revenue neutral, but they're not actually letting the American public hear the same thing. And instead, they're kind of taking a tone of just trust us because, you know, we've talked with the experts who say that this will work.
And I think that is what's sparking a lot of the protests in D.C. We did see shades of that back during the healthcare debate. As you pointed out, Andrew, that was done over a more exhaustive period of time and there was more access. But at the same time, certainly conservatives felt that that was jammed through without enough oversight from their side of the aisle. So, but anyway, we want to make one last note from this week. On Thursday, did you see this? Mayor Lenny Curry released the city's big video pitch to bring Amazon's second headquarters to Jacksonville. Now, their big headquarters is in Seattle. But what the mayor's office put out is video that shows land that appears to be the shipyards and Metropolitan Park, which are owned by the city. If Jacksonville were to land this Amazon HQ facility, that's many jobs that pay up to $50,000 a year. Of course, many cities are trying to land Amazon's big headquarters. Is Jacksonville's bid a long shot? A.G. Gankarski.
That video bore very little resemblance to the Jacksonville in which we live. It's a nice theory. It's nice to think they can just, you know, put the Amazon campus on the shipyards and, you know, build a transportation system that we haven't managed to build in the last 50 years and all of that. But, you know, it's predicated on a fiction. And I don't know if Jacksonville really can match the tax incentives that are going to be offered by places like Chicago, Newark, things like that. The free land is one thing, but and the riverfront view is beautiful. But I think this is something where we just don't have the guns for this fight.
Let's forget the fact that this isn't going to happen. Let's put aside the fact that Jacksonville's not going to get
Amazon. How can you guys not think more positive?
How about some
positive thinking?
Well, let's put all that aside and put on our positive thinking caps. What is the actual proposal here? Are we talking a new sales tax increase to pay for infrastructure? Are we talking about a major taking out of bonds to
selling
pay for this?
Selling a utility?
It's always the bonds, isn't it?
I mean, we're obviously talking about selling this land. Well, not selling, giving away.
Cynicism from the media roundtable.
Well, no, I'm just saying let's take this seriously. And what is the actual proposal here? So we give away this land. Are we going to raise another half-cent sales tax, which puts us at the max? So we can't raise more for infrastructure spending. We take out bonds. I mean, what is the actual proposal here for what the city of Jacksonville intends to do to accomplish what it says it would accomplish to bring Amazon here? Even if we take this seriously, what are we actually? How are we going to be able to do this? And why are we not doing it now?
I mean, sell JEA, obviously. I mean, you can't just say that. I mean, the timing of this. Oh, well, let's sell JEA. We need to do it quick. By the way, here, Amazon, have the shipyards, 200 acres downtown. I mean, we'd be giving 200 acres to a private company who would then, based on my knowledge of Amazon's campuses, Amazon's other campus would be closed to the public. So nobody would have access to that land except employees, of course. And then we're going to have to incentivize them with however much money they want. Is that good for Jacksonville? The long term. I mean, we're going to get rid of a huge revenue stream in JEA if we do sell that utility. And forgive me for bringing that into this conversation, but that's something that they're looking at that seems like a cash grab. And what do we need the cash for?
My favorite part of that video. My favorite part of that video was when the voiceover, this millennial, unaccented guy who seemed like he should be working in a coffee shop, saying, "We're going to work and let you transform our culture with your social responsibility and blah blah blah." And to me, that video is basically saying, right now, we are not the city that could attract Amazon. Jackson would have to transform, and you know, we drive to the west side, we drive to the north side, we drive down Beach Boulevard. It does not match that Amazon image. That the video projected.
We're just not hip enough. That's what you're saying.
We're a blue collar redneck town.
I think the type of people who work at Amazon would want to walk across the street and, you know, not have to worry about tickets.
This is
well, you'll have cover chords.
And the circle gets the square. Okay. And with all of that said, luckily and finally, it's our look at this strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material, as listeners to this program know. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida, the Critter Edition. Yes, only in Florida does a thief steal frozen dogs.
Wow, 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 yippee, oh, yippee.
This happened in Bradenton, where police say an unknown suspect broke into a veterinarian's office and made off with a freezer unit. It had the remains of two dogs who were awaiting cremation.
That's cold.
It's terrible.
From classy to ashy.
Oh, AG, you're killing me over here. The suspect fled the scene in a dark, medium-sized pickup, and they're asking anyone with information about the crime to contact them. Only in Florida does not know the street value of frozen dogs or what anyone would do with one.
A popsicle.
If made available. Ouch! Okay, and finally, since we are in the state known for many bizarre stories about animals, only in Florida does paying hunters to bag pythons. Yes, pythons. Mm. Does it turn out to be a decent business model? Now, this program was launched by the South Florida Water Management District. It's drawn celebrities, politicians, and lots of positive buzz. So far, it's also bagged 753 invasive snakes.
How many of those are politicians and celebrities?
Exactly. But they did nab a monster 17-foot python just last week. Now, the governing board down there is going to spend another $125,000 on this effort and expand the hunt. This is a way to control elusive snakes blamed for gobbling up small mammals across the Everglades. They are the top predator in marshes in South Florida.
Oh, my.
We're in the wrong line of work, guys.
This is a job opportunity. You can go down there with a tracker. You can hire a tribal snake hunter from India, even dispatch a snake-sniffing dog to bag your python.
Don't we have American snake hunters? Why do we have to bring one from India?
This is how you get paid.
Oh, okay.
Hunters get paid $8.10 an hour to become part of the popular Python Challenge, and you get a bounty each snake.
Can I just say, I'm looking forward to next year is the election. There's the ag commissioner races up. At the debates, can we just have everyone bring out what is the biggest snake that you have caught, and can you please bring it on stage? I think that this is needed for Florida. I think that the ag commissioners need to say where they stand on Python.
I think you're volunteering
a political future for you, Andrew
this
Pantazzi.
This could be a new Visit Florida promo. Visit Florida, bag a snake.
Florida,
we'll be right back, everybody. And now, here's how you can support our fund drive. No snakes in our studio.
No snakes here. What you can do is make a call and show your financial support for this station and First Coast Connect at 353-9528 or 1-800-722-9528. Hi there, Kevin Mershart, producer of First Coast Connect. And I have some great news for you. We are looking for 4,500 new supporters this calendar year, and now we are down to 481 to go. That is great, because you want to know why? We were over 1,000 at this time yesterday. So we have cut that in half, more than in half. 481 to go. We got to get that by 6 o'clock tonight, and you can help make that happen. So become a sustainer at $10 a month. We'll stick it on your credit card, your debit card, or you just give it your checking account number, and we'll make sure those numbers stay securely safe. And then just those $10, $15 come out every month, and you're doing your support for your part to support the great programming you listen to here on WJCT. So how about doing it right now? You love this program. I know how many people just love listening to the Roundtable. Big fans of the Only in Florida. That's one of the things I get to do on a Thursday is dig up some Only in Floridas, and I always want to make sure, let's find something that's kind of fun to talk about. We're here for you. We enjoy the programming you enjoy every day. We get the Florida Roundup coming up at 1 o'clock today with Melissa, who's the co-host, and I co-produce. We talk about some great issues all over the country and all over the state. Now is the time for you to show your support for this, your public radio station. Make that call now, and thank you, 353-9528.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I push in the
Well, it's your chance to enjoy a wonderful life this holiday and even note a few entries into the Santa Land Diaries. We're listening to the music from one of the holiday shows that's coming up at the Pontevedra Concert Hall, courtesy of Apex Theater Studio. Ian Mayers is managing director. And what song is this?
This is an original song by Duffy Bishop, an amazing blues performer who's opening tonight for us at the Sandland Diaries. Duffy is amazing.
Fantastic.
She's out of Seattle, and she winters here in St. Augustine.
Oh, she's one of those people. Winter is a verb.
But she's falling in love with North Florida, so I think it's becoming a year-round gig.
Excellent. So tonight it's the Sandland Diaries at the Pontevedra Concert Hall, and if people have never seen this show, it's hysterical. It's about one man's real-life experiences working as an elf at Macy's in New York.
It is. It's really what made NPR's beloved David Sedaris a star. He started reading entries from this on Morning Edition, and people were wrecking their cars.
It was so
laughing
funny.
Laughing so yeah, hard. I was one of them, right? And then someone had the great idea to turn to a stage play, and I started doing it many years ago. This is my 11th year doing it.
You're playing the elf.
I play Crumpet.
Oh,
Crumpet the
my
elf.
Goodness.
Crumpet, who changes his elf name to Blisters towards the end of the holiday season.
Because why does he do that?
He's had it. He's standing for 10 hours at a time.
I would think it's one of the lowest circles of hell to be an elf at Macy's at Christmas.
Absolutely.
Time.
And everybody can connect to it because everybody's had a service-related gig. I think you worked at McDonald's in Ohio, young lady.
My very first job.
Boom. I worked at the
Kaufman Avenue branch.
There
that was
go.
The better McDonald's in Fairborn, Ohio. I'll have you know.
So we've all dealt with the public. And
I
we
worked
all
at
know
the Kaufman
that.
Avenue branch, baby.
We all know that customer service
oh, yeah.
is a nightmare over the holidays. People want
it. It's terrible.
So this guy takes this gig because he's desperate for work, and he starts, you know, meeting all sorts of people at Macy's.
So the Sandland Diaries is on stage tonight and
tomorrow
night.
Yes.
But and that's then, not all you got planned.
Are you kidding me? We have a smorgasbord, a virtual smorgasbord of holiday programming. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, we have the Best Christmas Pageant Ever, which is a hilarious and wonderful show for families. It's just under an hour, and we encourage children to wander up and down the aisles. It's about a group of rowdy kids who infiltrate a Christmas play at a church because they hear the snacks are better.
That's true.
And they change the lives of the other parishioners in this church. It's really funny, but it's also quite moving. And it mm-hmm. has 26 fabulous artists from Apex Theater Studio and a few faculty members who I've bribed with peppermint schnapps to appear.
You know what you're
them.
Doing. Your mama didn't raise no fool.
And that's okay. Also tomorrow at 6 as well, and then Sunday at 2.
Okay, so two big shows this weekend, and then Ian has even more goodies in his bag of Santa gifts because you're staging the Christmas classic, It's a Wonderful Life, the radio play, the reenactment of the live 1940s radio broadcast of It's a Wonderful Life. That's coming up next weekend.
Yes, and this is really how all this holiday programming got started, Melissa, is we did it for one night last year. It's five actors in a radio set with a Foley artist who makes 200 live sound effects, and the audience also joins in. And we did it for one night, and it was magical. And a man came up to me and said, I brought my 95-year-old grandfather, I brought my 9-year-old daughter, and our whole house was transformed. And so I thought, this is the way we've got to cap this holiday season. And it's quite moving. And in these times we live in, after listening to the roundtable this morning, we all need to laugh, and we all need to connect as a community in a loving way. And that's what these shows do.
They really do. So kudos to you, Ian Mayers, for putting it all together. How can people get their tickets?
They can go to pvconcerthall.com or just show up. It's looking a little tight for Sandland Diaries tonight, but I think we have tickets available for tomorrow evening. They can go online. But
all right, pvconcerthall.com to get your tickets for all the holiday shows of Apex Theater at the Pontevedra Concert Hall. Ian Mayers, happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and happy elfing to
you. Yes, and you are a holiday treasure, Melissa.
Thank you. And in a moment, more holiday news here on First Coast Connect. Stay with us.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Michael Cavendish and Cavendish Partners, PA. Intelligent management of lawsuits for companies, investors, and executives. Offices in downtown Jacksonville. On the web at cavpartners.com.
Is America ready to bring North Korea in from the cold?
Let's just meet. We can talk about the weather if you want. We can talk about whether it's going to be a square table or a round table if that's what you're excited about.
We'll wrap up the biggest developments from Asia, the Middle East, Africa, and Central America on the global edition of the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
The new film, The Post, starring Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, is about how the Washington Post publisher Katherine Graham and executive editor Ben Bradlee defied a federal judge by publishing the Pentagon Papers. They risk going to jail and the ruin of the paper. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our interviews with the late Graham and Bradlee. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Many of our most beloved Christmas traditions come from Germany, where families still hold tight to the old ways.
We get together and sit in one room, just candles in our hand, and we sing as a family together the old traditional songs.
And in England, don't look for a star at the top of the tree.
And always on the top was a fairy.
Enjoy holiday traditions from our good friends in Europe on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday mornings at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally this hour, come on out to the Brooklyn neighborhood this weekend for a special concert at Unity Plaza, raising funds for Bright Holidays. Every year, Bright Holidays ramps up at this time to help underprivileged students and families. Getting all kinds of goodies to kids on a seasonal basis. It's all volunteer, and they operate through the help of the Duval County Public Schools. Now, one of the performers at the big concert is a student in the Duval County Public Schools. It's 16-year-old Madison Carr, who is a rising musical star here on the First Coast, and she joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. So you have just been on a tear lately with your music, and this will be a chance for people to come out and see you perform live. Who else is on the bill, and what all can we look forward to at the concert?
There's going to be two other bands there, Allie and the Cats and Chris and Chelsea, and it'll be from 1 to 4, and it's just a good chance to come out and hear some music.
And this is 1 to 4 on Saturday, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So when people come on out to the Riverside Arts Market, they can kind of wander on over to Unity Plaza and see you.
Yeah, right after.
Yeah, yeah. Right afterwards. So you've been performing at folk festivals. You've done all kinds of I saw you at the Girls on the Run 5K just a week or two ago singing the national anthem.
Yeah, yeah.
You're performing everywhere. It's exciting to see you popping up all over the place.
Thank you. It's anytime I can get out, I always learn so much each time, and I always meet so many amazing people, so I'm really lucky.
We're lucky now because Madison's going to perform for us. What are you going to be singing?
This is a song that I wrote called Math, and it's actually, I'm not very good in math classes. I think I'm a lot better with reading and language. But this song is more about not being good with numbers. It's more about making things black and white when in reality a lot of them are gray. So
here she is, Madison Carr.
If it's too hard to label into a class, or if it's too hard to tell if it's a fail or a pass, there's an easy solution. Turn it into math. Black or white, don't want the gray, but everything goes both ways. If you don't know what to say, turn it into math. I don't like to play notes on a page and sign it off as art. And there's nothing that I hate more than mechanical pieces and parts. I said your mind is moving low, and when your hands are feeling slow, and when reality's the only place you got, don't you know, turn it into math. said I almost failed, but I passed. Second class stuff, those questions you wanna ask. Life doesn't last, go ahead, turn it into math. You make the universe a map, complete with a moral compass. It could tell you your next life and your last, thanks to turning it into math. I said my head is weak and my hands ache, too much of staying in the same place. Life doesn't last, go ahead, turn it into math. I said I almost failed, but I passed. Second class stuff, those questions you wanna ask. Oh, life doesn't last, go ahead, turn it into math. Turn it into math. Turn it into math. Turn it into math. Thank you.
Madison Carr.
Thank you.
She is 16 years old, people. What a talent you are. I know big things are in your future. I'm so pleased to have you on the show again. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Come on out and see Madison and a great lineup at Unity Plaza tomorrow from 1 to 4. It's all to benefit Bright Holidays. Go to brightholidays.org for more. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. The unimpeachable Kevin Murchard is our producer. The serene and majestic Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. Musical genius Pyotr Chevchik composed our show theme. And make sure to send any emails and feedback to our email address, firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Also, don't forget to join us at 1 o'clock this afternoon for the Florida Roundup. 1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this has been First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. Have a great weekend, but right now, here's how you can make some end of your giving here to WJCT.
And what you need to do is pick up that phone and make that call at 353-9528 or 1-800-722-9528 or go online at wjct.org. Hi there, Kevin Murchard, co-producer, as you just heard, of First Coast Connect and of the floor co-producer of the Florida Roundup coming up at 1 o'clock today. Hey, we are less than 500 people to go to get new supporters to reach the goal for this year. Just 481 to go. We were at 1,000 yesterday at this time. So how is that for fantastic? That means we can make it happen today. You can make it happen today. We also need to raise about $25,000. We get 481 new supporters. We'll pretty much reach that goal. So make that call now. Today is the last day of our winter drive. It is the last day of Pledge Drive for 2017. I want to thank all of you who have called in and shown your support for this station over the years, and this year, it's been fantastic. Make that call now, and thank you. Once again, the number is 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528, or go online at wjct.org, and thank you.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.